From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Rolott, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Welcome to Worldviews. We'll get an update on the situation in Syria from Joshua Landis and how chemical weapons affect the public's view of the civil war. We'll also talk about the Edward Snowden case and the complexities of asylum and extradition.
It is scary. We're in a new world where nothing is private. At the same time, people are frightened in this new world, and they want this surveillance. And the animosity against Snowden has surprised me.
And later, Joshua Landis and I talk with author Pamela Olson. She grew up in eastern Oklahoma and just wrote a book about the 2 years she lived in Palestine.
And they said, wasn't there a bombing? And I was like, well, yeah, there was one bombing almost 10 years ago. Like, I don't know, we're in occupied Palestine and this guy's worried about Oklahoma being dangerous. It struck me as really bizarre.
Fast times in Palestine. But first, this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Rolott. Joshua Landis and Rebecca Cruz, we're all back together here in Norman. Welcome back.
Good to be here again.
Well, Joshua, it's been a while since we've been with you, and since we last saw you, something's changed regarding the civil war going on in Syria and the United States' response. So the United States has now admitted that Syria crossed that red line, they used chemical weapons, and are now providing military aid directly to the rebels. So big change, obviously. Is this going to make a difference? What's the backstory here?
It does make a difference. President Obama has said on Charlie Rose show that it doesn't really make – it's not a change of policy. It's just doing the same. But it does make a big difference. The United States is now supplying lethal aid. There's a presidential finding. We don't know how big the arms will be. But Saudi Arabia and others are saying – Kuwait are saying they're going to supply ground-to-air missiles and other heavier arms. So this is clearly turning the spigot, and it means we're siding with the rebels. And once you get all the CIA and everybody else in there and our trainers and special forces, then they want to win. They're not just going to do it to play patty cake.
So, and winning means getting rid of the regime.
No, it doesn't necessarily. We don't know. I mean, Obama says that winning right now means changing the balance of power enough to force Assad to the negotiating table in a Geneva-type conference with Russia and America in the background. But most people don't expect that to bear fruit. So it does get you into potentially this, are we going to conquer Damascus, a city of 5 million people with small arms and cannons, which means blowing the whole thing apart and having millions more refugees come out? What do we want to do? Conquer the whole country with these rebels who are untrained?
Well, that's the question. What do we want to do? Are we being clear about that?
Nobody has said what we want to do. And this is why so many people have been worried about the slippery slope and mission creep. And here we go again. Obama says we're not going to do Iraq. This is not Iraq. But it's hard to know the differences.
Well, another interesting story to be watching this week is the Edward Snowden on the run. Somebody working for the NSA and spills the beans, I guess, about surveillance activities going on in the government and then hits the road and ends up in Hong Kong. Obviously, this is against the law in the United States, and we're trying to track him down. So he ends up in Hong Kong, next to Moscow. Question is where he's going to go next. Asylum is a possibility in Ecuador. There are questions of extradition, questions of international relations. Here, Rebecca, good heavens, what a mess this guy's created. But on the one hand, we want to know these things. On the other hand, he's created this significant international incident.
Well, and think of the countries that he's gone to, Hong Kong, which obviously is attached to China. They have some autonomy. And then to Russia, where we end up kind of having this weird Cold War type scenario where we're talking about espionage with our old adversary. And we have noticed kind of a toning down of words between Putin and the Obama administration in regards to extradition. And then we look at Ecuador, who we do have an extradition treaty with, though there is some leeway there. And they are talking about potentially giving him asylum. We know, of course, that they did provide asylum to Julian Assange of WikiLeaks. He is holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. And he himself has also offered to assist Snowden. And this has kind of turned into an interesting political game of cat and mouse or of politics, obviously, with President Correa of Ecuador claiming that they will make the right decision. They will use their own sovereignty. And we have members of Congress now threatening to block some special provisions provisions and economic ties with Ecuador, which is only continuing to create animosity between the two. So we will see what happens here, but it is a lot of intrigue and kind of an old Cold War novel, if you will.
What I find most perplexing and interesting about this story is how torn Americans are. On the one hand, they're terrified of this new security state, of having a Homeland Security that's one of our biggest agencies. It is scary. We're in a new world where nothing is private. At the same time, people are frightened in this new world, and they want this surveillance. And the animosity against Snowden has surprised me. He's not a hero at all. It reminds you of Manning with the WikiLeaks and who's been sort of crushed like a bug and kept in solitary confinement.
And that's the U.S. military officer that's spilled.
Yes, and there's a difference between military and civilians.
Shared some secrets there, yeah.
But clearly, the United States is becoming much more – it's a different United States when it comes to prisoners and how they're being treated. And they don't know which way is the right way to go forward on this, whether to crush them like a bug as an enemy who's run to China and Russia, or whether – in fact, we should know about these secrets and this surveillance.
Well, and because we're torn, perhaps this is why he chooses to run. And I guess the outcome on for him personally and for relations among these nations is going to be very interesting.
Well, perhaps focusing on his run means that we're not focusing on the bigger issue of our own personal security and what we're willing to allow the government to do here.
Well, that is a subject for another day. Joshua, Rebecca, thank you both so much for being back here on Worldviews.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
If you have a question or comment for Joshua, Rebecca, or me, send us an email to worldviews@ou.edu. You can also follow us on Twitter at worldviewsKGOU. Coming up, Joshua Landis and I talk with Pamela Olson. She's a native of Stigler in eastern Oklahoma who just wrote a book about the 2 years she lived in Palestine. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot. My guest today is Pamela Olson. She grew up in Stigler, Oklahoma, about 200 miles due east of Norman on Highway 9. She studied physics and political science at Stanford University and moved to Palestine for 2 years after she graduated in 2002. She settled in Ramallah, where she worked as the head writer and editor for the Palestine Monitor. She also served as the foreign press coordinator for Mustafa Barghouti's 2005 presidential campaign after the death of Yasser Arafat. She returned to Washington, D.C. in 2006 to apply what she learned in the Middle East to her work at a Defense Department think tank. She's just written a book about her experiences called Fast Times in Palestine. Pamela Olson, welcome to Worldviews.
Thanks very much.
So tell us about what took you to Palestine. You wrote a book about it. We'll get into the book. But what even took you there to begin with?
So it started – so I studied physics in college, and I loved physics. I still do. But I started to realize that even physics is actually political because, you know, who's applying for the grants, who's giving the grants, what are the policies that are putting this technology versus that technology, you know, in place in the U.S. because I was interested in alternative energy. And so I started studying politics as well. And then I studied abroad in Moscow for a semester. And I just found that, you know, learning a Russian phrase in the morning and using it in the afternoon and, you know, learning about the conflict in Chechnya from Chechen refugees and mothers of soldiers, and then later when I took the train across Siberia from the soldiers themselves, was a lot more engaging to me than sitting in a dimly lit basement laboratory kind of watching numbers tick on a machine. So when I graduated, I started thinking about how I could do more of this travel and learning languages and the things I really love doing. And it happened to be right after 9/11 and right as the Iraq War was getting started in 2003. At the time, I was dating a Lebanese guy. And the way he talked about Lebanon was like it was Club Med or something. Like, the beaches are beautiful and the women are gorgeous and the food is amazing and, the mountains and this and that. And then, you know, on the news you hear, oh, it's a vast desert full of caves and Kalashnikovs and misogynistic bearded maniacs who want to kill you for your freedom. So there was kind of a little bit of a cognitive dissonance going on, and I wanted to check it out for myself. So I ended up meeting a friend in Egypt. And we just did touristy things in Egypt for a few weeks, and that was plenty adventurous enough for me. And then he left. And then by the time I got to Amman, Jordan, it was the fall of 2003, and the Iraq War was 6 months old. And, you know, I had been told from sort of the news back home that, you know, the Iraq War is more or less under control. It's fine. It's going to be over soon, whatever. And, you know, I stayed in a hotel where journalists were staying and foreign aid workers.
And they were saying, no, it's not fine. It's bloody chaos. It's getting worse. It's going to be, you know, years and years of it, it's probably heading towards civil war. Of course, it turned out they were right. But at the time, I didn't know who to believe. And I thought about visiting Baghdad and seeing it for myself. And then I got talked out of it. Some journalists were like, you know, look, kid, you're not ready for what you would see in Baghdad right now. Then I met a couple of guys who were doing work in the West Bank. And they, you know, we became friends. We traveled together a little bit. And they told their stories from the West Bank. And this was, you know, also kind of a bad year for the Second Intifada. And their stories were similarly just totally opposite world from what you hear, what sort of the basic understanding of Israel-Palestine is in the U.S. And, you know, more or less just to call their bluff, I followed them in and went to the West Bank with them. And sure enough, everything they had said had actually been toned down for my consumption. It was actually much more extreme than what they were saying.
And you decided to stay. So you end up in the West Bank, you know, just kind of on a whim, it sounds like.
Yeah.
But you decided to stay. Why?
You know, I was intimidated. I was worried because this was the first conflict zone I'd ever been in. But just immediately I was made to feel so welcome and people were so kind. And they asked me where I was from and I said, Oklahoma. And they said, oh, Oklahoma, it's a dangerous place. And I was like, what have you heard about us? And they said, wasn't there a bombing? And I was like, well, yeah, there was one bombing almost 10 years ago. Like, I don't know, we're in occupied Palestine and this guy's worried about Oklahoma being dangerous. It struck me as really bizarre. But also, as you know, if you know nothing about a place except whatever building blew up, then that's kind of that colors your perception of that place. So it was very humbling in that sense, and also in the sense that at first I was hesitant to tell people I was American because I'd been told that they hate you for whatever reason. And everyone was like, no, we understand. You know, we don't like your government, but you're an individual. You're coming here to see for yourself. We really appreciate this. And just in a million ways, people were so welcoming. And I met a guy who spoke Russian, a Palestinian guy who spoke Russian. And, you know, of course, I had studied in Russia. So we had our own, like, secret language together. And we started kind of having a little, I guess, flirtation at first. And then it kind of went from there. But and also, you know, the olive harvest was right around this time. And that was such an incredibly fun experience. Just, you know, the kids running around and the olives all sort of falling from the trees and onto the tarps. And it's like this olive rain. And, you know, at the end of it, you're going to get an RC Cola bottle full of very fresh, ripe olive oil. And it was Ramadan. It was like the perfect storm of, like, you know, perfect time to be there. And, you know, during Ramadan, you think it's going to be, oh, everyone's fasting and depressed and this and that. But in fact, it's like, in my case, it's kind of like watching music videos all day and then feasting and partying all night. And every night I had at least 5 invitations to different people's homes. And so I got to know the whole village and people were so kind. And so all of that together, plus the complete insanity of the situation and trying to understand it, really sort of hooked me and pulled me in.
Our guest is Pamela Olson, a native of Stigler, Oklahoma, and the author of the book Fast Times in Palestine, chronicling the 2 years she lived and worked in Ramallah. More after a break. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews on KGOU. I'm Suzette Grelot, the dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Today, we're speaking with Pamela Olson. Her memoir, Fast Times in Palestine, describes her experiences living in Ramallah nearly a decade ago. When we left off, she was telling us how friendly and welcoming she found Palestinian residents.
So I have to ask, what's the difference between the narratives or the reality that you saw and the narrative that you imagined, that you had learned in the United States?
Sure. So the narrative you learn in the U.S. is vaguely sort of basically there's a country called Israel and then there's these people called the Palestinians and they both sort of want the same land and they both sort of have sort of armies and they both have casualties and Israelis are pretty much like us. You know, they're sort of like they look white and they speak English and this and that. And the Palestinians are sort of not like us. You know, they're sort of angry and they, you know, bearded and they're strange and they don't speak our language and all this kind of stuff. And also you think of the West Bank or the Palestinian areas as being just these demolished, rubble-strewn wastelands, you know, whatever, and just full of, like, angry, strange people. But the reality I found is Palestinians don't really have an army, and they, you know, they lived on the land for many centuries before there was a state called Israel. And, you know, you can argue about the founding of the State of Israel, but the fact was 750,000 Palestinians were driven out of their homes and land And in the West Bank and Gaza, 4 million people now live under total military occupation where, you know, they don't have rights to vote in Israel, although Israel controls their lives. And they don't have access to a civilian court system. The Israeli military court has jurisdiction over them. And it has something like a 99% conviction rate. And then the systematic violence against Palestinians, there would often be something like, oh, a Palestinian attack shattered a 6-month lull in the violence. And that would be like the headline in the U.S. And sort of maybe 14 Israelis were killed in an attack by Palestinians. And then you look at the past 6 months and you'd see that 300 Palestinians were killed and 0 Israelis were killed. So a lull in the violence in the U.S., you know, media just means no Israelis were killed. It doesn't mean no Palestinians were killed. But the Palestinian sort of the everyday brutality against them, it doesn't make headlines as much as the spectacular few, you know, relatively few attacks by Palestinians.
But haven't Palestinians been given many opportunities for peace, for compromise, and they've rejected them each time? What choice has there been for a real solution?
Well, that's another element of the common American narrative is that the Palestinians never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. It's actually much more complicated than that. The Palestinians, since 1988, the Palestinian Authority has recognized Israel as a state. And the entire Arab world, in fact, in 2002, agreed to recognize Israel in exchange for peace based on international law, based on 1967 borders, based on a shared Jerusalem for a capital, you know, Israeli West Jerusalem and Palestinian East Jerusalem, and acknowledging the rights of Palestinian refugees. These aren't based on particular Palestinian prejudices. These are based on international law. So far, actually, in fact, it's Israel who's rejected that formulation of it because essentially for now, for them, the occupation is, I mean, they're able to, with relatively little cost, you know, maintain these cities they've built in the West Bank illegally, illegal settlements, and extract water from the West Bank, you know, and use it for however they like and sell part of it back to the Palestinians for an inflated price. And, you know, because the U.S. holds veto power in the U.N. and is allied with Israel, we essentially allow them to get away with these violations of international law. And so as long as there's no cost to them for maintaining the occupation, they're probably going to maintain it. And as long as the U.S., you know, sort of has this policy of Israel right or wrong, I don't see anything good happening in that region as far as, you know, moves toward peace.
So your book, Fast Times in Palestine, what do you mean by fast times?
You know, when I first stumbled into the West Bank, as I mentioned, it was the sort of perfect storm of all these things going on, all these things I'm learning, all these people I'm meeting. It was very overwhelming. I liken it to like a machine gun barrage of things that I'm learning and seeing and impressions and that kind of thing. And then I moved to Ramallah, the big city, to volunteer with a progressive political leader. And sort of just as I'm getting settled into that whole thing, because there's a big learning curve, of course, then I was offered a job as head writer and editor of the Palestine Monitor. And, you know, I was like, are you sure you have the right number? You know, I'm a physics major, ex-bartender, volunteer from Oklahoma. Like, I'm not sure you want me to be running an entire news organization. But they're like, oh, you'll figure it out. So I kind of spent, you know, 3 months just cramming all this knowledge into my head about how to be a journalist and about, you know, all of these terminologies and the trends and learning how to report on each death. Every morning I woke up and it was like who had died the night before. And just when I kind of was getting into the groove with that, then Yasser Arafat died and my boss decides to run for president of the Palestinian Authority. And because all of the other foreigners would be going to England or Spain or Australia for the Christmas holidays, I was the only native English speaker left. So I kind of by default, I became his foreign press coordinator. So that was like the most intense 2 months of my life was that sort of presidential campaign when I'm doing my full-time job and doing the full-time job of being his foreign press coordinator. And then when that finally died down, I don't know, it's like different people came to visit and my parents came for a visit. I had to show them around and then I'd need a new visa. And then it was just like, it was really probably the most intense year and a half I hope to have in my life.
So it's about the intensity of the situation. So not only personally, but politically, socially, in every respect in this part of the world, it's so intense, right?
It is.
And so what's going to get them out of this situation? What is going to help them reduce that intensity?
I don't see very much hope, and most Palestinians don't see much hope from the so-called peace process that the U.S. is supposedly trying to resurrect. The thrust of every peace process before has been talk, 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 expand the settlements, nothing happens, blame the Palestinians. Like, that's how it always tends to go. So they kind of already have seen this movie and they're not really hopeful about a different ending this time. What can they do? I mean, for one thing, there's a massive movement of nonviolent resistance in Palestine that just recently was featured in the New York Times Magazine, finally, after many years of being ignored. It's finally starting to be recognized and mentioned in sort of mainstream U.S. news sources. And the article is called "Will the Third Intifada Start Here?" And it's online and well worth the read. So there's definitely that is helping little by little to change American public opinion. I hope my book can also help at least allow people to engage with the conflict from a more realistic perspective as opposed to the sort of the narrative that we get here. It's just not very realistic. It's not very closely aligned with actual reality. We would actually very often, and we'd be in Palestine watching something happen, and then we'd go home, turn on CNN and watch the coverage of that thing and be like, what are they talking about? This has nothing to do with what we just witnessed, or they missed the point, or they missed the larger story and just focused on one small thing. So, yeah, I'm hoping that at least in this one arena where it's still, there's kind of a democracy of ideas more and more because of blogs and Palestinian writers and movies like Five Broken Cameras and hopefully books like mine, that at least in that sense we can start changing American public opinion and maybe eventually have an impact on U.S. foreign policy.
You've been taking your book across the country. What's the reception been like? Mm. What do your parents think of all this? What do Oklahomans think about when you bring this talk to Oklahoma?
Well, this is my first day in Oklahoma, or just sort of speaking in Oklahoma, and so far it's been great here, but it's probably sort of a self-selected crowd. All over the country so far, it has been surprisingly receptive. I was kind of waiting for some kind of backlash or dissension, but so far it's been, again, probably self-selected crowds, but still, people have been very respectful, very open. As for my parents, they actually came and visited me in Israel-Palestine. And, spoiler alert, we had a wonderful time. But they were also very shocked by a lot of things they saw.
They weren't frightened to go there?
They were, but I had to essentially emotionally blackmail them and say, like, if you love me, you'll come and see what my life is like over here. I think they were more afraid of that. So,
all right. So very quickly, are you headed back?
Not anytime soon, but I usually go back about every 2 years. But I'm getting married this year, and then there's going to be a move next year. And so I'm not sure exactly when this is going to happen next. But it's like a second home, and I always miss it.
Well, congratulations on your marriage.
Yes. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Pamela Olson, for joining us on Worldviews.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
You've been listening to our conversation with Pamela Olson, a native of Stigler, Oklahoma, who spent 2 years living and working in Ramallah. You can read an excerpt of her book, Fast Times in Palestine, by visiting our website, kgou.org. The University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies produces Worldviews through a collaborative partnership with KGOU. Mackenzie Samus prepared the research for this interview, Hallie Arias creates our content on the web, and Brian Hardzinski edits the program. For Rebecca Cruz and Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Grelott.